Hello, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. This is supposed to be a podcast relating to some high yield step one topics. I basically created this by going through the different high yield resources that everyone uses. And I just try to pick up on some high yield information and just put it into a keyword format in slides. And then I'm just going to talk about these, okay? I hope you find it marginally helpful, and I guess we'll just go ahead and get started. So, keyword number one, the most commonly occluded vessel in an MI, hopefully you know this to be the left anterior descending artery, okay? Remember, this is a branch of the left main coronary artery, and hopefully you know this, that this will be associated with ST elevations in leads V1 through V4, pretty much, okay? And then the infarcted vessel causing an AV block. Well, the thing with that is that the AV node is supplied by an artery known as the nodal artery. Okay, and this nodal artery is classically a branch of the posterior descending artery. And as we know, in 85% of individuals, the posterior descending artery comes from the RCA. So an RCA infarct may cause an AV block. And hopefully remember that this will be associated with a PR interval prolongation on an EKG. Now, the papillary muscle that's most susceptible to a rupture, step one loves this for some bizarre reason, but this is the posterior medial papillary muscle, okay? The reasoning behind this is this muscle has only one blood supply. Its blood supply is from the posterior descending artery, again, classically from the RCA. So, if you have an RCA infarct, you can have ischemia of the posterior medial papillary muscle, and you can actually have a flash regurgitation, which can cause a massive pulmonary edema, okay? And contrast this with the anterior lateral papillary muscle has two sources of blood, the left anterior descending and the left circumflex, okay? So it's less susceptible to ischemia. The only thing that will cause ischemia is if you, by some bad luck, have those two vessels knocked out, or you have your left main coronary artery knocked out, because remember, it's the precursor to those two vessels. And then coronary vessel dominance. This is just a concept that relates to the source of your posterior descending artery, okay? Your posterior descending artery in 85% of individuals, it comes from the right coronary artery. So most people are right heart dominant, okay? In some people, it comes from the left circumflex, okay? This is about 8% of people. And then the least common permutation of that is the posterior descending artery coming both from the left circumflex and the RCA. That'll be a co-dominant heart, okay? That occurs in about 7% of people, okay? Now, the next question talks about the first-line treatment of psoriasis and acne. For this, hopefully you know that this is a topical retinoid, okay? And retinoids, remember that they are vitamin A analogs. In fact, that's why I put the 15-17 translocation association. Remember your all-trans-retinoic acid that is used to treat acute promyelocytic leukemia, which is a kind of AML. Okay, remember the classic histologic finding of our rods that if they leaked into the circulation during surgery or chemotherapy, for example, the person could have a DIC and they could actually die from that, okay? And you should also remember that vitamin A, right, retinoic acid, sort of want to avoid excess in pregnant women because it's a teratogen, okay? And the last thing I just put here with regards to the sun and skin cancer, right? So we know that obviously, like, oh, don't bathe in the sun, or oh, stay away from tanning salons and tanning beds, right? Because, oh, you could get skin cancer from that. So what's the reasoning behind that, right? So we know that ultraviolet rays cause skin cancer. Like there's UVA rays and UVB rays. And it so happens that the UVB rays are the ones that are probably more dangerous, okay? Because they have a shorter wavelength than the UVA rays. The UVA rays have a longer wavelength. So that's why they say, oh, use sunscreen. And sunscreen, the protective agent in sunscreen, at least against UVB rays, which is the more dangerous one, is PABA, okay? So para-aminobenzoic acid. Hopefully you still remember that PABA is an analog that is used, is actually a substance that's used in certain microorganisms to make folic acid, okay? Remember that PABA is acted on by dihydropyrite synthase to make like certain intermediates in the folate synthesis pathway in microorganisms. And remember that they're PABA analogs, right? Like your sulfonamides. They actually look like PABA and they work by inhibiting dihydropyrite synthesis. So think about, for example, like Dapsone or SMX that you find in trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. And then if you wanted to block both UV and UVB rays, you would want a sunscreen that contains zinc oxide. Okay, zinc oxide. So obviously that's probably preferred over something that just contains PABA. So next slide. Now, hyponatremia, hypotension, and hyperkalemia in a patient with a history of a recent severe Neisseria meningitis infection. Well, what are you thinking about here? Are you thinking of adrenal hemorrhage, potentially from Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome? Well, if you're thinking about that, then that's great, okay? Super high yield condition to know for step one. So this is basically hemorrhage into the adrenal gland. So this can cause a primary adrenal insufficiency. And if you have a primary adrenal insufficiency, right, your adrenal cortex no longer works. If it's not working, you basically have reduced aldosterone activity. Remember the zona glomerulosa that ordinarily makes aldosterone, which is a kind of mineralocorticoid. So if you're not making aldosterone, you have reduced the activity of that INEC channel at the principal cell of the collecting duct. So you no longer reabsorb sodium. If you're not reabsorbing sodium, you become hyponatremic. It also so, and because sodium is not being reabsorbed, you also have less water reabsorption. So your blood volume goes down. Okay, that's why you become hypotensive. In addition, remember that your zona fasciculata, right, your source of glucocorticoids makes cortisol. And cortisol actually has a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system. And one of the mechanisms behind that is that cortisol actually helps with epinephrine synthesis in the adrenal medulla by activating the enzyme PNMT, right, that uses SAM, S-adenosylmethionine, as a cofactor, right? So remember, methionine is a methyl carrier in the body, and the big difference between norepinephrine and epinephrine is a methyl group, okay? So PNMT is activated by cortisol, so that's potentially one mechanism behind the permissive effect of your sympathetic nervous system on, of cortisol on your sympathetic nervous system. And then jumping back to that fancy principal cell in the collecting duct, right? So remember that INEC channel, as sodium comes in, okay? Potassium is extruded in a coupled transport mechanism. So if you have low levels of aldosterone, right? That INEC channel doesn't work, okay? So by virtue of that, that ROMK channel doesn't work as well. So you do not extrude potassium. That's why you get hyperkalemia, okay? In primary adrenal insufficiency. And the most common cause of primary adrenal insufficiency in the U.S. is Addison's disease, okay? That's an autoimmune destruction of the adrenal cortex, okay? Cortex. In developing countries, think more of TB, okay? So if they give you a step one question where they describe, they say, microscopic examination of a biopsy specimen from the adrenal cortex reveals caseating granulomas, you really want to think about TB infection, okay? Causing primary adrenal insufficiency. And then in primary adrenal insufficiency, you classically get hyperpigmentation. And the reasoning behind that is if your adrenal cortex is not working, there's no cortisol that's going back to give a negative feedback to the anterior pituitary. Okay, so you make a ton of ACTH. Okay, now it so happens that ACTH comes from a substance known as POMC, okay, propiomelanocortin. And POMC is a precursor of ACTH. In addition, it's also a precursor of MSH, melanocyte stimulating hormone. So if you're making a ton of ACTH, right, you also in the self same way make a ton of MSH. If you're making a ton of MSH, you have stimulation of melanocytes and you can get skin hyperpigmentation. In addition, a person that has primary adrenal insufficiency, as they're making more ACTH and more MSH, they're also making a lot of beta endorphin. Beta endorphin is actually also derived from POMC. And remember that beta endorphin is a mu opioid receptor agonist. Okay, it's just one of those bizarre things step one wants you to know. Now, if a person has primary adrenal insufficiency, again, they're making less aldosterone from the zona glomerulosa. And if you go to the collecting duct, remember there is alpha intercalated cells that pump protons into the urine side of the nephron, okay? And that proton pump is activated by aldosterone. So if you have a low aldosterone state, aka type 4 RTA, You're not pumping protons into the lumen of the into the urine side of the nephron, okay? And you get a metabolic acidosis because you're basically retaining protons, okay? And remember that in primary adrenal insufficiency, you have an eosinophilia, okay? If you remember, like your NAACP or DNAACP or Canada P mnemonic for the differential diagnosis of eosinophilia, one of the A's in those mnemonics stands for Addison's disease. Okay. Now, if a person has secondary adrenal insufficiency, okay, the problem or the pathophysiology is that these people's anterior pituitary no longer works. If it no longer works, you're not making ACTH. If you're not making a ton of ACTH, you're also not making a ton of MSH, okay? So there is no, very high yield, there is no skin hyperpigmentation in secondary adrenal insufficiency. There is also no hyperkalemia, okay? Because again, the problem is your anterior pituitary does not work. It does not mean that your adrenal cortex is not working as well. Because remember, yes, if you're not making ACTH from the anterior pituitary, your adrenal cortex is not receiving stimulation, okay? But remember that the only parts of the adrenal cortex that depend on ACTH stimulation primarily include your zona fasciculata that makes glucocorticoids and your zona reticularis that makes sex steroids, okay? Remember that your zona glomerulosa that makes mineralocorticoids, case in point, aldosterone, receive stimulation from the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system that basically starts in the afferent arteriole of your, the JG cells of the afferent arteriole of your nephron under the control of beta-1 receptors, okay? So if your adrenal cortex is functional, so for example, in the setting of secondary adrenal insufficiency, you actually have normal aldosterone levels. So your principal cell with the Enoch channel and Romke channel working just fine. Okay, so you actually do not get a hyperkalemia in secondary adrenal insufficiency. And if you want to test for adrenal insufficiency, with regards to sequential testing, right? The first thing you want to do is you want to document that, okay, this person has low levels of cortisol, okay? So one way you can figure that out is just by checking the body's cortisol levels at a time where it's supposed to be high, okay? For example, if you have, think about it, if you wake up in the morning, you're about to go for one of your med school lectures or the morning of your step one exam, you're like super stressed, you're like super on edge, right? So your cortisol level should be crazy high during that period. Well, if it's low, then you're like, maybe this person has a adrenal insufficiency. But the thing you do after that is to ask yourself, where is the lesion? Okay, and one way you can confirm that is by checking ACTH levels. Okay, if your ACTH levels are super high, then you know that there is loss of negative feedback, so the problem has to be at the adrenal cortex. But if your ACTH is super low, okay, that means that the problem has to be a step higher in the anterior pituitary. Okay, it could also potentially mean the problem is in the hypothalamus, right? Because if you have low levels of CRH, you also have low levels of ACTH. Okay, now. And then you can do something known as a cosyntropin testing. Cosyntropin is an ACTH analog. If you give cosyntropin and the person's cortisol levels do not rise, then you're also potentially thinking of a primary adrenal insufficiency, right? Because it means that, oh, the adrenal cortex is not responding to ACTH, to exogenous ACTH administration. Okay, now let's look at selected disorders with metaroprone exposure. The thing is, metaroprone is an inhibitor of 11-beta-hydroxylase. It so happens that 11-beta-hydroxylase helps with the conversion of 11-deoxycortisol to cortisol, okay? So in a normal person, if you give metaroprone, you inhibit 11-beta-hydroxylase, those people's levels of cortisol will go down, okay? And because their cortisol levels are going down, you will have a release of negative feedback at the anterior pituitary. If you release negative feedback at the anterior pituitary, okay, the person's ACTH levels will go up, and the substrate that lies just before 11-beta-hydroxylase, which is 11-deoxycortisol in this case, will actually go up as well, okay? Now, let's assume you have primary adrenal insufficiency, okay? If you have primary adrenal insufficiency and you give a person metaroprone, okay? Again, metaroprone will inhibit 11-beta-hydroxylase. I mean, in primary adrenal insufficiency, your cortisol levels are already low, but let's say, oh, it goes down even more, okay? But if you have primary adrenal insufficiency, think about it, right? Your ACTH levels will already be high, okay? So giving metaroprone will make it even higher. But Think about this. What will be true of your level of your levels of 11-deoxycortisol? Well, I'm hoping you're saying it will be low, right? Because again, if your adrenal cortex is not working in Addison's disease, for example, you cannot respond to that ACTH stimulation, okay? So your 11-deoxycortisol level is actually low, okay? Now, let's assume a person has secondary adrenal insufficiency, okay? And you give me tiropron. Again, you inhibit 11-beta-hydroxylase, cortisol levels tank. Okay, if your cortisol levels tank, you expect that your ACTH should rise, okay? Because you're releasing that negative feedback. But if your anterior pituitary is not working in the setting of a secondary adrenal insufficiency, your ACTH levels will fail to rise, so they'll be low, and your 11-deoxycortisol levels will also be low, okay? So, because again, if ACTH is not around, 11-deoxycortisol will not be made, okay? So, in the normal case, you give me tiropron, your ACTH and 11-deoxycortisol levels increase. If it's primary adrenal insufficiency, the only thing that goes up is ACTH, okay? In secondary adrenal insufficiency, both things are down, both your ACTH and your 11-deoxycortisol. And basically, if a person has a primary adrenal insufficiency, well, you just simply need to give them what they're missing, okay? So the thing that's missing in primary adrenal insufficiency are glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids, okay? So you can replenish the glucocorticoids by giving dexamethasone, okay? You could also give hydrocortisone, for example. And then to replace the mineralocorticoids, you can just give fludrocortisone, okay? And then if a person has secondary adrenal insufficiency, again, remember that the zona glomerulosa is under control of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So the only thing you really need to give those people glucocorticoids, again, like dexamethasone or hydrocortisone, okay? And then just remember the association that if a person has been on chronic steroid use, has been using steroids for a long time, and they get some kind of stressor like surgery or an infection or whatever, okay? You want to go ahead and give those people a stress dose of corticosteroids. Okay, next slide. So a 7-day-old with a prenatal history of a screening ultrasound revealing increased nuchal translucency has failed to pass meconium. So what's the diagnosis? Well, increased nuchal translucency, what are you thinking about here? Well, I hope you're thinking about Down syndrome, okay? Trisomy 21, okay? So if you have trisomy 21, it's basically like you see all these disparate findings, but the primary problem is neural crest cell migration, okay? So this kid actually has Hirschsprung's disease, okay? You're supposed to pass meconium within 48 hours, okay? Your first poop as a kid. So if you have Hirschsprung's disease, you may not pass meconium, the kid may actually have abdominal distension and all that bad stuff, okay? So the pathophysiology is a failure of neural crest cell migration, okay, to the distal GI tract, okay? So if you were to do some kind of biopsy of the rectum or distal GI tract, for example, you will not see your Meissner's and your Auerbach's plexi, okay? Remember, your Meissner's plexus is in the submucosa, okay, of the GI tract. Your Auerbach's plexus is in the muscularis externa part of your GI tract. Remember, that's between your inner circular and your outer longitudinal layers, okay? So what are the layers of the GI tract, right? So the layers of the GI tract, basically you have three big layers, okay? You have your mucosa. Actually, sorry, you have four big layers. You have your mucosa, okay? After that, you have your submucosa. After that, you have your muscularis externa. And then after that, you have your serosa, okay? And remember, your serosa is lined by simple squamous epithelium, okay? Which is classically known as mesothelium, okay? So mucosa, submucosa, muscularis externa, and serosa. Now, it so happens that the mucosa and your muscularis externa have sublayers, okay? So the sublayers of your mucosa include the epithelium that's on the surface facing the lumen, okay? Below that, we have supportive connective tissue known as the lamina propria, okay? And then below that, we have a kind of muscle known as a muscularis mucosa, okay? Muscularis mucosa. And then for the muscularis externa, it has two subparts, okay? It has an inner circular layer, okay, and an outer longitudinal layer. And a very easy way to remember that is inner. The I in inner is the same as the I, which is the second letter of circular. And then the O in outer is the same as the second letter in longitudinal. Okay, easy way to remember that. And again, remember that your Auerbach's plexus is between that inner circular layer and the outer longitudinal layer. Okay, contrast that with your Meissner's plexus that is in the submucosa. Okay, now, what are the distinguishing features of the duodenum? Well, the big thing you want to remember are your Brunner's glands. Okay, remember that nasty acidic stuff coming from your stomach sort of kind of needs some kind of neutralization. Okay, so you want to make bicarb to counter that. So the way you counter that is with the Brunner's glands. Brunner's glands, they make bicarb. Okay, they are found in the submucosa of the duodenum. Okay, and then the terminal ileum, the special thing with the terminal ileum are the pious patches. Okay, they are lymphoid cells. They are basically like lymphoid follicles that you find in the lamina propria of the terminal ileum. Okay, remember your terminal ileum is also where you reabsorb vitamin B12, and it's the most common region that's involved in Crohn's disease. Okay, and if you torch your terminal ileum in Crohn's disease, you can have a B12 deficiency. Now the esophagus. The esophagus is kind of special for certain reasons. Okay. We know that in the GI tract we find primarily smooth muscle, but things are kind of different in the esophagus. Okay. The upper third of the esophagus actually has skeletal muscle. The lower third actually has smooth muscle. And then the middle third has a mixture of both. Okay. The middle third has both smooth and skeletal muscle. Okay. And the esophagus actually does not have a serosa like other parts of the GI tract. Okay. It actually has an adventitia. In fact, this is the lack of an serosa is one of the mechanisms behind metastasis of esophageal cancer. And then for the small intestines, remember we have the fancy villi and microvilli, and we have like the plica circularis. Those measures all increase absorptive surface area. Okay, and please remember, they can, this is one very nice way they can integrate this concept on step one. If a person has, remember your microvilli sort of constitute your brush border, okay? There are certain high-yield enzymes that work along that brush border. So remember your lactase, okay? So step one could describe like an Asian that has like flatulence and diarrhea and bloating after consuming milk. Think about a lactase deficiency, okay? But they know that everyone has memorized lactase deficiency, so they can just pose an answer choice that says deficiency of a brush border enzyme. Okay, and also remember your diabetes drugs like acarbose and miglitol. Okay, they work at the brush border. They inhibit disaccharidases. Okay, in this case, alpha glucosidase. Okay, so you do not reabsorb sugar because you're not converting disaccharides to monosaccharides. Okay, remember we have no ability to absorb disaccharides, and that's how they treat diabetes, because they basically make you poop out sugars. Okay, next slide. Now, a 7-year-old child in a developing country with a recent history of treatment of severe meningitis presents with pallor and fatigue. Pallor and fatigue, what are you thinking about with that? Anemia, maybe? Okay. Now, they say that there's a predominance of adipocytes observed on bone marrow aspiration, right? So this is basically code word for a dry tap on a bone marrow aspirate, okay? So hopefully you're thinking of aplastic anemia with this. And then you see developing country, severe meningitis, recent treatment. What drug are you thinking about? I'll give you a hint. This drug causes gray baby syndrome. Well, I hope you're thinking of chloramphenicol. Okay, chloramphenicol, it's a 50S inhibitor. Okay, it actually inhibits peptidotransferase. Okay, and a common side effect, at least a classically tested side effect is aplastic anemia. Okay, so that's what this kid has. And basically, the retic count will be low because you've injured a person's precursor blood cells. Okay, and the EPO levels will be high because your body's like, where are my red cells? So it tries to compensate by increasing the release of EPO from the peritubular cells in the nephron. Okay, and other drug causes, again, remember your C's like carbamazepine. Carbamazepine is a classic cause. Remember your anti-thyroid medications like PTU and methimazole. Those also cause an aplastic anemia. Okay. And if a person has sickle cell, okay, remember those people are, they really, really, really depend on the production of red cells. So they could potentially have an aplastic crisis with a Parvo B19. Okay. Remember Parvo B19, remember your classic slap cheek rash. And remember that it's one of those high-yield single-stranded, in fact, it's probably the only single-stranded DNA virus that you do need to know for step one, okay? Now, finally, in the bottom part of the slide, I talk about Café au lait spots, a small head, hypoplastic thumbs, and a type 2 RTA. So what are we thinking about here? Café au lait spots. Café au lait spots are not only found in neurofibromatosis, or only in Albright hereditary osteodystrophy. If you see Café au lait spots and you see the qualifier that, oh, this person has hypoplastic thumbs and a type 2 RTA or proximal RTA, well, hopefully you're thinking about Fanconi syndrome. Okay, Fanconi syndrome. Fanconi syndrome usually presents with like thumb problems. Okay, it can also present with an anemia every now and then. You can basically have problems with the transporters in your proximal tubule, so you can actually present with a type 2 RTA, okay? And the pathophysiology here is just a problem with a double-stranded DNA break repair, okay? So your non-homologous end joining essentially does not work, okay? So this is Fanconi syndrome, okay? Fanconi syndrome. Okay. So, next slide says recurring UTIs in a patient on chronic treatment for type 2 diabetes. Okay, so if a person is being treated for type 2 diabetes and they get a ton of UTIs, what's the drug you're thinking of? Well, I hope you're thinking of an SGLT2 inhibitor, okay, like canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, or empagliflozin. So, they inhibit SGLT2, so you do not reabsorb sodium and glucose in the nephron. Okay, so glucose shows up in your urine. Okay, that's how they lower your blood glucose levels. But again, if you really think about this, if you put more glucose in the urine, right, you're essentially creating a Valentine's Day for bugs. Okay, so you could potentially get recurrent UTIs with the SGLT2 inhibitors. Okay, now the proximal convoluted tubule, remember it has microvilli, just like the small intestine, and that should make sense because again, it's the workhorse. Okay, so it reabsorbs a ton of nutrients. Okay, now PTH, remember PTH stands for phosphate trashing hormone. Okay, so the mechanism behind PTH trashing phosphate is that it actually inhibits a co-transporter of sodium and phosphate at the proximal tubule. Okay, remember sodium is primarily an extracellular ion, so as it flows down its gradient, you can pump things against their own gradient, like taking phosphate from the proximal convoluted tubule from the urine side of the proximal convoluted tubule into the actual PCT cell. Okay, so PTH works by inhibiting that sodium phosphate co-transporter. Now, angiotensin II actually increases the activity of a sodium hydrogen antipodder that you find at the proximal tubule, right? So why is this an antipodder and not a sympodder? Again, this should hopefully make sense. If sodium is flowing down its gradient into a cell, okay, if you're bringing in positive charges into a cell, you want to sort of counterbalance that by bringing out positive charges, okay? So the positive charge you bring out in this case are protons, okay? So those protons, they basically bind with bicarb that has been filtered from Bowman's from Bowman's capsule, okay? They combine with the bicarb under the activity of carbonic anhydrase, okay, which you find on the microvilli of the proximal tubule. You form carbonic acid that splits off to form CO2 and water, okay? You reabsorb that, and you basically have the CO2 being converted back to bicarb, which is reabsorbed on the blood side, and the protons, which again take that route through the sodium hydrogen antipodder. Okay, so angiotensin II actually increases the activity of this sodium hydrogen antipodder. So if it increases its activity, you should sort of realize that you'll be dumping more protons in the urine side of the proximal tubule, and as you're dumping more of those protons, you're actually reabsorbing more of the bicarb. Okay, that's the mechanism behind the contraction alkalosis that you get with that you get in a person that is volume down from taking a diuretic, for example. Okay, because they are volume down, okay, so their volume is contracted. That volume down state increases the activity of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. Okay, so you make renin from the GG cells of the of the afferent arteriole that converts angiotensinogen from the liver to angiotensin 1, okay? And then the lung endothelial cells convert angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, okay? And angiotensin 2, one of the things it does again is to increase the activity of that sodium hydrogen antiporter, okay? And just remember that if you got an experimental question, for example, and they were like, oh, a person has if you're looking at levels of angiotensin 1 and 2 in the pulmonary artery versus the pulmonary vein, where would you have higher concentrations of angiotensin 2? Well, I really hope you're thinking about the pulmonary vein, okay? Because it's the endothelium of lung capillaries that contain angiotensin converting enzyme, okay? So your angiotensin 2 levels are actually much higher in the pulmonary vein because they are distal to the pulmonary capillaries, okay? Compared with the pulmonary arteries. Okay, good. Now, the RT associated with dorzolamide use. Dorzolamide is just like acetazolamide. I remember your sulfur allergies. These drugs work by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase. Okay, and when inhibiting carbonic anhydrase, you can basically replicate some of the findings you get in a type 2 or proximal RTA. Okay, so remember, it's one of those RTAs where you have hypokalemia. Okay, and you get a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis with that, okay? And just real quick, as an aside, what is the bone disorder associated with a mutation in carbonic anhydrase 2? Well, the answer to that is osteopetrosis. Okay, next slide. Now, these are just some quick neuroassociations, right? So what's the infarcted CNS structure in a chronic alcoholic? Well, I hope you're thinking of the mammillary bodies. Okay, they look like breasts. You find them around the pineal gland. And that's in Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Okay. Now, the atrophied CNS structure in a patient with a CAG trinucleotide repeat disorder. Okay. Well, I hope you're thinking about the caudate nucleus. Okay, it's atrophied in Huntington's disease. Okay, so you could potentially have something known as hydrocephalus ex vacuo. Okay, because the caudate is getting smaller, your third ventricles could actually look bigger than normal. Okay, actually, your lateral ventricles could look bigger than normal. Sorry about that. Now, arterial ischemia associated with contralateral loss of all sensory and motor function. This is very highly tested on step one. Remember, it's your fancy lenticulostride arteries. Okay, remember, these are derived from the middle cerebral artery. Okay, so if you have ischemia of your lenticulostrides, basically your posterior limb of the internal capsule doesn't work anymore. Okay, and if it doesn't work anymore, all your somatosensory information is gone because they all sort of crowd into that space, and also all your motor information is gone. Okay, the reason you get contralateral motor problems is that by infarcting, remember your motor, your descending motor fibers, primarily your corticospinal tract, decussate at the medullary pyramids. Okay, now the reason you also get contralateral sensory loss is, again, a lot of your sensory information sort of crosses on the way up through the thalamus. Okay, as they go on to the postcentral gyrus of your cerebral cortex. Okay, and then lucid interval, subsequent coma, athlete hitting the head with a bat. Well, I hope you're thinking of your lens-shaped epidural hematomas with that. So that's a fracture of like the temporal bone. So your middle meningeal artery is gone. Okay, remember, it's one of the branches of your external carotid. Okay, and then crescent-shaped lesion in a shaking baby. That's a subdural hematoma. Remember, it's besides the shaking baby syndrome. Subdural hematomas may also be found in chronic alcoholics because their heads get tiny, or person that is old because, again, as you get older, your cerebral cortex sort of shrinks. Okay, and remember, it's involvement of the bridging veins that creates a subdural hematoma. Okay, now, next slide. Proximal muscle weakness, skin findings in a smoker with new onset hyponatremia and a CT detected thoracic mass. So this person is a smoker, right? You've seen a mass. They have lung cancer, okay? They have hyponatremia. So is there a particular kind of lung cancer you're thinking about here? Well, I hope you're thinking about small cell lung cancer. Okay, remember it's paraneoplastica phenomena like SIDH, which can cause a hyponatremia. Remember it's more hypo or smaller euvolemic hyponatremia. It can also make a ton of ACTH. Okay, so you can get ectopic ACTH secretion. Remember that's the one that is not suppressible with high dose dexamethasone. Okay, and you can also make autoantibodies against the presynaptic calcium channel. Okay, so you have something known as Lambert Eaton and myasthenic syndrome, and when you have that, remember that's the muscle weakness that gets better with use. Okay, because the more you use the muscle, the more you recruit calcium to that presynaptic calcium channel, they outcompete the nasty autoantibodies. Okay, and then the person's muscle weakness sort of improves. Okay, so proximal muscle weakness in this case with skin findings. I added this qualifier of skin findings to get you thinking more of like dermatomyositis. Okay, the thing is, dermatomyositis actually is a relatively common paraneoplastic phenomenon, also associated with small cell lung cancer. Okay, so what's the difference between poly versus dermatomyositis, right? So polymyositis has no skin findings. Okay, that may not always be true, but on NBMEs it's generally true. No skin findings in polymyositis. In dermatomyositis, you do actually have skin findings, right? And it's easy to remember that because there's derm in dermatomyositis. Okay, and the skin findings you find in, you get in dermatomyositis include things like the raccoon eyes. Okay, so that's like the heliotrope rash around the eye. There's the there, like if you think of an anterior redness of your neck and your like the anterior thoracic cavity, you're thinking more of like the V sign. Okay, but if you go to the back, you're thinking more of the Schall sign. Okay, and then remember those Gottron's papules that you also get on the fingers. Okay, you could actually also have a Miller rash. Okay, just like lupus, it's just the Miller rash in lupus does not involve the, it actually spares the nasolabial folds. The Miller rash you actually get in dermatomyositis does not spare the nasolabial folds. Okay, and in dermatomyositis, the cells that are involved, okay, are your CD4 positive T cells. Okay, and I guess B cells as well. But for polymyositis, it's actually more your CD8 positive T cells that are involved. Okay, and those cells, they cause inflammation of your perimysium. Okay, and basically the structure around the fascicles of your skeletal muscle. Okay, that's more dermatomyositis. So you'll find perimysial and perifascicular inflammation in dermatomyositis. In polymyositis, you actually find more of you have inflammation more around the capsule that surrounds individual skeletal muscle fibers. Okay, your endomysium. So you have endomysial inflammation in polymyositis. And dermatomyositis, it's more common in kids compared with polymyositis. That's more common in adults. Okay, so think of dermatomyositis, the D as being an earlier letter in the alphabet, that's kids. Polymyositis being a P, later letter in the alphabet, that's more adults. Okay, and classically, like your muscle markers, right, like your LDH, so lactate dehydrogenase, your creatine kinase, okay, those are classically elevated in dermato and polymyositis. Okay, and then you associated autoantibodies. There's your anti-JO1 antibody. Okay, that's an antibody against like a tRNA synthetase. I think it's like histidyl tRNA synthetase or something like that. We have the anti-MI2 antibodies. Okay, those antibodies against the helicase. Okay, and then we also have antibodies against the signal recognition particle, SRP. Okay, remember your signal recognition particle is what sort of threads partially synthesized proteins through the into the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum in the process of a protein synthesis. Okay, and really the way you do your diagnostic testing here is classically you observe like, oh, this person's creatine kinase is elevated, and then you're like, okay, let's do some extra stuff here. Every now and then you can do an MRI. Okay, but if the MRI doesn't pan out, you could potentially do like an EMG or some kind of muscle biopsy. Okay, and the way you treat dermatomyositis is with steroids. Okay, you give a systemic glucocorticoids to induce a remission. Now, pleural inflammation with pain and without pain. This is a classic anatomy question for step one. Remember, we have the visceral pleura, and then we also have the parietal pleura. Okay, the visceral pleura does not have pain innervation. Okay, but the parietal pleura does. So if you have pleuritis that involves just your parietal pleura, it hurts. Okay, so remember, like, your intercostal nerves do in fact innervate your parietal pleura. Okay, but your visceral pleura, you generally do not get pain if you have just if you have inflammation limited specifically to the visceral pleura. Okay, and then transudative versus exudative effusions, right? So your transudative effusions, there are certain causes, right? So like there's tons of causes, but I'll just say in general, like anything that raises the hydrostatic pressures in the pulmonary vasculature or decreases oncotic pressures would potentially cause a transudative effusion. Okay, so anything like CHF raises hydrostatic pressures. If a person has nephrotic syndrome, right, remember you're peeing out albumin, so your oncotic pressures in the blood go down. Okay, those things can all cause a transudative pleural effusion. Okay, remember, transudative pleural effusion is transparent. Okay, so the specific gravity should be less than your magic number of 1.012. Okay, and then your exudative effusions, I would just say to think of an exudative effusion as something that arises from increased vascular permeability. Okay, and the classic causes of exudative effusions include things like cancer, okay, like neoplasms. Infections could also cause exudative effusions. Actually, a pretty high yield fact to know is that pulmonary emboli cause both transudative and exudative effusions. I'm not exactly sure about this, but I'm just proposing a mechanism. My proposed mechanism is that initially, when you have those pulmonary emboli, you have an increase in hydrostatic pressures that causes a transudative effusion. Okay, but as those hydrostatic pressures get too high, you begin to blow out those pulmonary vessels. You then have increased vascular permeability, and you then get an exudative effusion. I'm also imagining that maybe as your immune system cells try to come and take care of the clots, the inflammation increases vascular permeability as well and could potentially create the exudative effusion. But again, this is my own teleological explanation. Doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Okay. Now, Light's criteria. This is more of a third-year concept, but basically just is a set of criteria that says the ratio of your pleural fluid to your serum fluid to your serum protein should be less than 0.5. The ratio of your pleural fluid LDH to your serum LDH should be less than 0.6. And your LDH should be no more than 2/3, the upper limit of normal of some magic lab value. Okay, basically, if you meet all three criteria, you have a transudative effusion. If you fail to meet, even if it's just one of those criteria, okay, you have an exudative effusion. So say, for example, the pleural fluid protein to serum fluid protein is greater than 0.5, okay, that will be associated more with an exudative effusion. Okay, so you need to meet all three criteria to be adjudged as a transudative effusion. Okay, and remember, your exudative effusion is not transparent. Okay, so the specific gravity should be greater than 1.012. Okay, now, so those are all Light's criteria. Now, if they describe a sudden onset chest pain in a patient with a history of emphysema, I hope you're thinking of the rupture of some kind of bleb or bulla. Okay, so that'll be a pneumothorax. Okay. And next one says, doneness to percussion with chest drainage, revealing fluid of high lipid content, right? So the lipid you're seeing is chyle, okay? So that's a chylothorax, okay? So you could get that from, I don't know, let's say you have like some kind of lymphatic obstruction by a malignancy, or you've transected the thoracic duct, okay? Because remember, chylomicrons travel in your lymphatic system, okay? And then, if you have a recent victim of a stab wound, and they say, oh, auscultation reveals dullness to percussion and decreased tactile fremitus. Well, hopefully you're thinking of some kind of liquid involvement in the pleural space, okay, of a hemothorax, because the person has been stabbed, so they probably bled into their pleural spaces, okay? Now, next slide. The three zones of the prostate, again, this is how they can test histology or anatomy on step one, okay? If you're going from outside in, okay, there's the peripheral zone of the prostate, okay? If you come to the middle, you have the central zone of the prostate, okay? And then if you come to the area of the prostate that is juxtaposed to the prostatic urethra, okay, we're dealing with the transitional zone of the prostate, okay? So the way to remember that the mnemonic is like PCT, like proximal convoluted tubule. You have like peripheral, central, and transitional zone, okay? The transitional zone is also called the periurethral zone, again, because it's juxtaposed to the prostatic urethra, okay? Now, if you then understand what I just said, it should then make sense that it's that transitional or periurethral zone that overgrows in BPH. That's a benign prostatic hyperplasia, okay? Because if that region overgrows, that can begin to compress the urethra, and you can get BPH symptoms, okay? And the hormone that drives the growth of the prostate, okay, is dihydrotestosterone. Remember, dihydrotestosterone is derived from testosterone by the enzyme known as 5-alpha reductase, okay? So if you inhibited 5-alpha reductase with a drug like finasteride or dutasteride, you decrease the synthesis of DHT. If you decrease DHT synthesis, you can, over time, like over like 6 months, shrink the size of the prostate and chronically relieve the symptoms of BPH. But if you're like, I don't want my patient to wait for 6 months, or you're like, okay, I'll give you this 6-month medication, but let me also give you something that can sort of immediately relieve your symptoms, think of giving an alpha-1 blocker, okay? Like tamsulosin, for example. Tamsulosin is an alpha-1 blocker, more specifically the alpha-1 AD receptors in the prostate, and by opening up the urinary sphincter, the person's urine can drain out pretty well, okay? You can also give other drugs like prazosin, doxazosin, terazosin, but those drugs are less specific for the alpha-1 receptors in the prostate because they also block the alpha-1 receptors you find on the vasculature, so they can decrease the systemic vascular resistance and cause an orthostatic hypotension as a side effect, okay? And other things you could do for BPH, right? You could chop off some part of the prostate, so you can do like a transurethral resection or whatever it's called. Let's see, another alternative. Let's see, the person, they could give you like a mean step one question where they say, oh, this person has like suprapubic fullness, right? And they have like a post-renal esotemia picture where their BUN to creatinine is like, at least in the early phase, the BUN to creatinine could be like, I don't know, like less than 20, and FINA could be like greater than 1% and stuff like that. You're seeing like, oh, post-renal esotemia, and they can say, oh, what's like the quickest way to relieve this person's symptoms? You can do that by inserting like a catheter into the bladder, like a Foley, okay? So you can drain that bladder, okay? You can very quickly relieve the obstruction, because remember, an obstructive uropathy is the most common cause of a post-renal acute renal failure, okay? Now, the common location of prostatic malignancies, think more of the peripheral zone, okay? That's where most prostate cancers arise, right? That's why when you go for a digital rectal exam, they try to, and guys, again, remember to go for those kinds of exams when you get older. But basically, you palpate the peripheral region of the prostate, and you could potentially try to detect a malignancy, although malignancies can also arise in other regions, okay? So I guess that's why a prostate biopsy may ultimately be helpful. Okay, now, blood supply to the prostate. Blood supply to the prostate comes primarily from the inferior vesicle artery, okay? That's a branch of the internal iliac, okay? And in general, if you remember the arteries, you'll remember the venous drainage, right? So it should make sense that there probably exists like some inferior vesicle vein that drains the prostate, that then supplies, drains blood into the internal iliac vein, which then becomes the IVC at some point, okay? And a 55-year-old female with, I originally wrote female, let me change that to male. Because females do not have prostates. Okay, back to the real world. So, 55-year-old female with, male Divine, come on. 55-year-old male with a history of treated prostate cancer presents with low back pain. Low back pain. Low back pain. Okay. So, and I see that an MRI or bone scan reveals a singular lumbar lesion. Well, I hope you're thinking about metastatic prostate cancer. Okay. Remember, prostate cancer tends to cause blastic lesions. Okay. It's one of the high yield causes of blastic lesions. Okay. And the way you can treat this is potentially give because remember, androgens drive the growth of the prostate, so you can give an androgen receptor blocker like a flutamide or bicalutamide. Okay, like flutamide or bicalutamide. Okay, and then next slide. So 45-year-old male presents with 10 out of 10 sudden onset abdominal pain. Now here's the kicker. EKG reveals an irregular interval. What is this? Well, I hope you're telling me that this person has acute mesenteric ischemia, okay? If you have an irregular interval, you have AFib, okay? If you have AFib, you could potentially have like stasis of blood in the left atrial appendage. You can create an embolus. Okay, remember, stasis is part of your Shi mnemonic and varicose triad. Okay, so you can form an embolus, it can flick off and go to one of the blood vessels in the, it can actually go to one of the blood vessels in the brain, so you could get a stroke, or you go to one of the blood vessels in the GI tract, classically the superior mesenteric artery. Okay, the superior mesenteric artery. So this person has acute mesenteric ischemia from embolization of a clot. Okay, to a GI tract blood vessel. Okay, again, most commonly on exams, it's the superior mesenteric artery. So, what are the branches of the superior mesenteric artery? You may be like, there's no way I need to know these things for step one. Well, think again. Okay, you do actually need to know the branches of the SMA. Okay, and the other branches of your GI tract blood vessels, like your celiac artery and stuff like that. Okay. So, the SMA, it's the blood supply to the mid-gut, okay? Remember, your celiac artery is the blood supply to the foregut, and your IMA is the blood supply to the hindgut, okay? So, your superior mesenteric artery, it basically supplies blood from, it supplies like your ascending colon, supplies the proximal two-thirds of your transverse colon, up until the splenic flexure. Okay, so remember the splenic flexure is a watershed area, okay, because that is where like SMA blood flow stops, and that's sort of where IMA blood flow stops as well. Okay, so again, I could have easily said in this question that the person had left upper quadrant pain, okay, because the splenic flexure was ischemic, okay, and remember that splenic flexure is where vagus nerve, your cranial nerve 10, vagus nerve innervation ends. Okay, so the branches of the superior mesenteric artery, one branch is the right colic artery, okay, that supplies your ascending colon. Then there's the middle colic artery that supplies your transverse colon, at least the proximal two-thirds. And then I believe there is also an ileocecal branch that sort of supplies your ileum, okay, your ileum, your appendix, your cecum and stuff like that. So ileocecal, so ileum plus cecum, okay? Remember, the appendix is sort of in that ileocecal area, so that should sort of, you can sort of make that knowledge leap. And then there is another branch known, I believe, as the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery, okay? The inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery. Remember, the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery anastomosis with the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. And hopefully you remember from anatomy that the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery. Okay, the gastroduodenal artery. Remember that gastroduodenal artery supplies, basically forms a part of the right gastromental artery that supplies like the greater curvature of the stomach, at least one half of it. And that gastroduodenal artery also happens to be a branch of the common hepatic artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery, which is the blood supply to the foregut. Okay, so again, celiac artery forms the common hepatic artery, which has the gastroduodenal artery as a branch. The gastroduodenal artery is the creator of the right gastro-omental, or you can call it gastroepiploic artery, that supplies the greater curvature of the stomach, okay? But another branch of the gastroduodenal artery is the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery that anastomosis with the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery, which is a branch of the superior mesenteric artery, which is the blood supply to the midgut. Okay, I know that was kind of a lot, but it's one of those things you probably want to know for step one. Okay, now, differentiating nutcracker and SMA syndromes. Okay, so nutcracker versus SMA syndrome. So nutcracker syndrome, basically, these two syndromes involve something that's being compressed between the superior mesenteric artery and the aorta. Okay. In nutcracker syndrome, the thing that is compressed is the left renal vein, okay? If you compress the left renal vein, right, you won't have good drainage of your left testicular vein. And if your left testicular vein is not draining well, you could potentially imagine that you could have like a left-sided varicocele. You could have like pain in your testicles, okay? So an easy way to remember that it's the left renal vein that's compressed is to remember that in nutcracker syndrome, your nuts hurt, okay? I believe people refer to the nuts as, you know what I'm talking about, okay? So I'm going to keep going from there. But nutcracker syndrome is left renal vein compression between the superior mesenteric artery and the abdominal aorta, okay? Now, SMA syndrome, the thing that's compressed between the SMA and the aorta in this case is your duodenum. Okay, so if you compress your duodenum, you could potentially imagine a person presenting with like signs of a GI tract obstruction. Okay, and just real quick, let's assume you got a question about a person with a history of like a low posterior hairline, lymphedema around the neck, elevated blood pressures in the arms, but low blood pressures in the legs, and they tell you that the person has recurrent UTIs. And they say that, oh, you see a GU anomaly with a CT scan or an MRI of the abdomen. Well, I hope you're thinking about horseshoe kidney. This patient has Turner syndrome, okay? Horseshoe kidney where the inferior pole of the kidney fuses, okay, and is stuck under the inferior mesenteric artery. Okay, so next slide. So, comparing means of two groups. So, how do you compare means of two groups? Okay, use the T-test. Okay, T for two. How do you compare means of three groups? You use the ANOVA test. Okay, analysis of variance. So, three words. So, you're comparing means of three groups. Okay, now, what's the test that helps you calculate differences between categorical variables? Well, I hope you're thinking about the chi-square test. Okay, and when a confidence interval results insignificant, well, they love to test this on step one because it's sort of something people, many people don't realize for some reason, right? So remember, if two numbers are the same, if you take the difference between those numbers, you get a zero, okay? So if there are no significant differences between like difference of means, for example, if your confidence, it means your confidence interval will cross zero. Okay, so if your confidence interval crosses zero, okay, there's no significant difference between like a difference of means. Okay, now remember, relative risk is a ratio. Okay, if you have the same number in the numerator and the denominator of a ratio, okay, if you take that ratio, you get a value of one. Okay, so what do I mean by that? The thing I mean by that is whenever you have a relative risk and you get a confidence interval and it crosses one, there are no significant differences between the two relative risks that you're trying to compare. You can also extrapolate that knowledge to another ratio like the odds ratio, okay? Now, the mean, okay, how do you get the mean? You take a series of numbers, add them up, divide by the number of numbers, and boom, your mean shows up, okay? Now, how do you calculate the variance? Well, I'll just sort of talk you through this. But basically, what you do is each of the numbers in your number set, you subtract the mean from those numbers, okay? And then that mean difference for each of the numbers, you basically square all of them, okay? And when you square all of them, you add those numbers all together, okay? So you get a sum of the difference of means, okay? When you have that sum of the difference of means, you then go ahead and divide that number by your sample size, so your number of numbers, okay? When you make that division, you get your variance, okay? So your variance in words, because again, it's much easier to just sort of think about certain things. It makes more sense than trying to memorize the willy-nilly. But basically, your variance is the sum of differences in means divided by your sample size, okay? And if you so happen to take the square root of that variance number, you essentially get your standard deviation, okay? Your standard deviation, if you took that number and divided it by the square root of your sample size, your n, you get the standard error of the mean, okay? And that standard error of the mean is kind of useful because it helps you calculate your confidence intervals, okay? So how do you calculate your confidence intervals? You basically take your mean, okay, and you go plus or minus some number multiplied by the standard error of the mean. Okay, so what do I mean by some number? Some number relates to whether you're trying to find the 95% confidence interval or the 99% confidence interval. If it's the 95% confidence interval you're looking for, you multiply your standard error of the mean by 1.96. Just use 2 for step 1. And then if you're trying to do that for your 99% confidence interval, you go ahead and multiply by 2.58, okay? Just use 2.6 for step 1. Okay, and then your confidence intervals, what do they tell you? They essentially tell you that for the sample mean you've gotten, the population mean with 95% confidence falls within whatever boundary you derive from the calculation we just mentioned. Okay, so there'll be a 5% chance that the population mean does not fall within your confidence intervals if you're going with a 95% confidence interval, for example. Okay, and then remember your correlation coefficients, they basically show you a relationship between like your dependent and independent variables. Okay, if it's plus 1, it means that there's a positive correlation. If it's minus 1, it means there's a negative correlation. And the closer your R value is to the absolute value of like 1, okay, you have a stronger correlation that way. Okay, but remember, correlation does not imply causation. So next slide. 13b, so that's our last slide. So assuming a class mean score of 80 on step 1, a sample size of 16, and a standard deviation of 5, how many students scored above the 95th percentile? Okay, so you could use all these numbers I gave you, or you could just think, okay? You actually do not need to use these numbers. So think about it. If I'm asking for how many students scored above, okay? So notice this question is very, so asking a question that says how many students scored above the 95th percent confidence interval versus a question that says how many students scored outside of the 95th percent confidence interval, those are different questions. If I'm asking, oh, how many people scored outside the 95% confidence interval, I'm thinking more of the people that are like the extra, the 5% that I'm not accounting for. That 5% are the 2.5% that scored on the low end of things and the 2.5% that scored on the high end of things, okay? But if I'm asking for the people that just scored above the 95th percentile, I'm asking only for that 2.5%, okay, that scored above the 95th percentile in this question. And I mean, we can easily calculate that, right? We know that the standard deviation is 5 and the sample size is 16, okay? So we'll calculate the standard error of the mean, okay? So standard error of the mean will be 5 divided by the square root of 16, which I believe is 1 1/4. So that's 1.25, okay? So since we're dealing with the 95% confidence interval, we do 1.25 multiplied by 2, okay? So that's a 2.5. So basically, any score above an 82.5, okay, is higher than the 95th percentile, okay? So if we want to detect the actual number of students that scored above the 95th percentile, we just want to take 2.5% of the total sample size, which is 16, okay? So how do we do that? Let's see. I don't have a calculator with me, but 10% of 16 is 1.6. right? And 2.5% is a quarter of 10%. So that means if you take a quarter of 1.6, that means 0.4 students scored above the 95th percentile, okay? And again, remember, this is outside two standard deviations, and you can increase the power of a study by just increasing your sample size, okay? Increasing your sample size, okay? Another way you can increase the power of your study is to increase the effect size, right? So think about it. If you're trying to measure differences between like the wealth of Bill Gates and like the average med student, like that's a large effect size. Bill Gates is a billionaire. Med students, unfortunately, do not have as much money as Bill Gates. So that's a big effect size. The power of your study will be good, okay? But if you're trying to compare the incomes between two average med students, right? The income differences will not be big. The effect size is kind of small in that group, okay? So that's the end of today's discussion. I hope you find this helpful. I just tried to integrate as much as possible with these slides, and I'll see you at the next podcast. Thank you.